the smoking gun has smoked, and he really needs to go. There's other things to talk about. GM going bankrupt and transferring its mostly to us, the taxpayers, with a good portion left to the United Auto Workers. I think a solution that, well, is probably the only possible solution. I want to talk more about California's direct democracy, not just in Proposition 8. I touched on this a little yesterday, but I'll continue. It's ruining not only California, but it can harm the rest of us. We may all be on the hook because California voters are being, let's just say, a bit selfish. California, in fact, is a great example of the perils of direct democracy. Not something I complain about very often. Usually I complain there's too little democracy. But California is a great example of too much democracy. Sometimes it actually is better to have a representative to, help to deal with the contradictions. Having direct democracy, I think, sometimes is like children being in charge of their own food habits and deciding to eat candy, chocolate, and ice cream all day. I want to talk about that. I want to talk about how to respond to North Korea, a very scary threat. North Korea having detonated a nuclear explosion, one high enough to be measured on the Richter scale, and talking about invading South Korea. Yikes, that's a problem that Barack Obama really doesn't want, but he's got to deal with, just as he has to deal with Iran. And he is, of course, in the Middle East this week, and it's not getting that much attention in the press. It's a difficult balance, talking with all of those Arab dictators, including the ones that are our friends, who are so hated by their own people, whether in Egypt or Saudi Arabia or anywhere else, particularly in Egypt. I hope he still remembers human rights, even when we have to work with some of these dictators. It's a tough balancing act, but I think he has to do it. So on all these topics, and any other that is in your mind, this is a great day to call in, because it's the kind of day where, I mean, I get to all my topics, but you definitely can put me on track. 877-4HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. Let's start with Sonia Sotomayor, a woman who, the more and more I read about her, the more and more I'm realizing that she's a moderate Democrat. I guess she's liberal. She's certainly not left liberal. She is known, frankly, as someone who is good for business, fair on business. She's definitely not a liberal Scalia. And that's too bad. Maybe there is no Latina on the court in America that has the self-assuredness of a Justice Scalia. Of course, what she is very likely to be confirmed. Had Barack Obama put a more left-leaning judge on, then, there'd be a lot more fight in the confirmation. And, you know, I'm of two minds about all of this. I see Sotomayor is a lot like Chief Justice Roberts. And I think Obama's next pick, and he's going to get another pick, he has to get another pick, will be more on the lines of Alito, as a mirror image. Chief Justice Roberts, while definitely right-wing and conservative, has a demeanor of someone who's trying to work together. And frankly, although it's very hard to tell gradations on the far, far, far right, Roberts is less extreme than Clarence Thomas, Antonin Scalia, and Samuel Alito. That does not mean he's not extreme. It just means that on the level of extremity, he's not quite as far off the limb. He's certainly farther than Justice Kennedy. Here's the thing. Obama will get two picks. It is certain. And the reason it's certain is because Justice Stevens has been on the court since the days of Gerald Ford, who appointed him, back when Republicans were not necessarily conservative. Think about that. That's how long he's been on the court. He's in his late 80s. I think he's 89. He could be 88. I don't have his age in front of me, but he's definitely up there. And he definitely has made his transformation from a Republican appointee to someone who was pretty reliably in the moderate to liberal end of the court, definitely to the left of the center of the court, which is today held by conservative and Kennedy. Let's not forget, Kennedy is so conservative that he was willing to overrule the American people and give the presidency to Bush. But he's the middle of the court. Stevens is to his left. And Stevens will certainly retire under Obama. Stevens very much wants to be replaced by a liberal. If it looks like Obama's going to go toward re-election, he might just stick around. I think he's out to break the record. In 2 years, Justice Stevens will be the longest-serving justice ever on the Supreme Court, and I think he wants to hold that record, and then he'll probably step down, probably in Obama's first term. Though, if it looks like Obama's going to sweep to victory, possibly in his second term. It's impossible, that Stevens will not retire during Obama's term. He will not wait out and be 96 years old and wait for the next president. I'm quite confident of that. This is a man who has served his country very well. And even though he may want to be on the court till he dies, he recognizes that he's got to quit during a liberal president. So Obama's going to get two picks. And I think Sotomayor was his safe pick. This is the pick to replace Justice Souter. She largely would have the same views as Justice Souter, someone who is a moderate liberal, someone who is not the kind of intellectual powerhouse that, say, Justice Ginsburg is on the left-hand side, but someone who is respectably allows, you know, generally liberal views. But she's like Roberts in the sense that he knows she's going to be confirmed, and maybe because it's so early in his presidency when he wants to do so many things on health care, the environment, and energy, and so forth, maybe he felt like he wasn't ready for a fight right now. Well, that's good and it's bad. It's good because she'll be confirmed easily. It's bad, though, because if someone on the right were to retire, not just Justice Stevens, if Justice Stevens retires, I would really hope Barack Obama puts in a very, very strong liberal voice. Someone like Harold Coe, the dean of Yale Law School, someone who I worked with, I have a lot of respect for. I think he'd be the first Asian on the bench. You might as well put him up there as well. But I don't advocate for him because he's Asian. I advocate for him because he's a very, very powerfully strong legal thinker, someone who's not only equal to, but frankly a lot more brilliant than Justice Scalia and can give him a run for his money. Or someone like Kathleen Sullivan, another extremely brilliant mind, who I fear Obama would be afraid to put up, despite the fact that she is often mentioned as one of the most brilliant jurists in the United States because she is openly gay. And I'm not sure Barack Obama has the cojones to put up someone like that, despite the fact that it has nothing to do with her legal reasoning. But she would be the kind of strong liberal that I'd like to see there. I don't think Sotomayor is going to be that. And yet I suspect the right will tar her as being a radical lefty precisely because they feel like that'll make Obama less likely in the future to put up the kind of liberal intellectual force that I'd like to see. And in saying this, I hope this isn't seen as an attack on Sonia Sotomayor. I think she'll be a fine justice. She's not my first pick. I'm honest in saying that because I don't think she's liberal enough. But I do think she is liberal. I mean, I don't think she'll be much different than say, Justice Souter, for example. It's worth repeating that Barack Obama opposed the nominations of both Alito and Roberts. Now, Alito was easier to oppose. His views were more extreme from the outset, just as Roberts had views that were kind of hidden, actually. But Obama argued, when he was talking about his case against Roberts, this is in a really good op-ed by E.J. Dionne, that 95% of court cases are easily settled, and that's what the law says. But 5% of hard cases, Obama said in September 05, quote, in those 5% of hard cases, the legal process alone will not lead you to a rule of decision. And the critical ingredient is supplied by what is in the judge's heart. So what is in Sonia Sotomayor's heart? Well, in the 1990s, she was described as a centrist. Her sponsor in politics was New York Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who is certainly not a conventional liberal, as Dionne points out. Moynihan, of course, is the author of the Moynihan Report, which talked about the decline of African-American families way back in the 1960s. He's, while being liberal, Moynihan was always a thinker and not someone who simply accepted liberal orthodoxies. Indeed, he fought very hard to protect the black family at a time when that was considered a conservative thing to do. Business Week called her moderate on business issues. And, of course, there is that famous case where she said that the administration had the right to favor anti-abortion proposals and in determining where money went, as I talked about. The most famous thing, though, that the Republicans are bringing up, and it's the one that they're really trying to rebuild their party with. Remember, the Republican Party is such a small, decimated party, they could probably meet in a phone booth. When you're led by the likes of Karl Rove, Dick Cheney, and Rush Limbaugh, you know that those three fat, white, balding guys, extremists, they don't represent anywhere close to where most of America is. And they need to reach out. So they're going to reach out in the way that Republicans have traditionally reached out, to the broader racist community. You see, ever since Strom Thurmond would show the reverse affirmative action ads, the one where the white hands is getting a rejection letter because the black man got the job, they're going to try to show that appointing a Latino woman to the court is somehow damaging to white people, that white people need to be afraid of the minorities. And the best way to do that is to talk about a speech that she gave to La Raza. La Raza is the premier Latino rights legal rights organization, back in 2001. And I'll bet that you've heard the quote, or at least a rendition of the quote, where Newt Gingrich has said, for example, that she practiced reverse racism in saying that Latina women are better than white males. That's what Gingrich said. It must be true, right? And that he said if a racist white guy would be denied on the court, a racist Latina should be denied as well. It's a pretty strong claim to claim that she is a racist. And so I went back to the speech, the full speech, the full text. It's in the New York Times. You can find it if you have trouble finding it. Send me an email, mark@radioinsidescoop.com, post on my blog, and I'll post it there. But I wanted to read what she said, and it's a fascinating speech. In it, she talks about the paucity, the rarity of female judges, of African-American judges, of Latino judges, far, far, far below their population in the United States. These are already minorities. And yet they don't come close to the percentage of their population. And she goes through about women. She writes at the time that Latino women are 1% of the federal bench. African American women were 1.5%. This at a time when Latinos and blacks reach, you know, some 13% of the population. And she writes that we have a long way to go. And then she goes into the issue that she's received so much grief on and that you're going to hear many, many times, probably an attack at. Because after all, the Republicans were planning to attack whomever Obama chose. And so they got to spend the money. Even though she will be confirmed and even though Republicans are going to, I assume, fear attacking Latinos, if they don't fear it, then, well, They're in even more trouble than I expect. Even so, all the people have been paid off. All these attack groups with names like, I don't know, Citizens for Justice. That may be a real name. If it is, I apologize to whatever group that is. But you get the idea. People allied for goodness in the American way. Oh, look, that one is actually a name of a liberal group. Anyway, people with all kinds of strange names representing right-wing conservatives will join the attack. And they're going to attack her based on this speech. And she goes and she cites a professor of mine, Stephen Carter of Yale Law School. when he writes that in any group of human beings, there's a diversity of opinion because there's both a diversity of experiences and of thought. Professor Judith Resnick said there's not a single voice of feminism, but because there are many different ways in which women are distinct from men. She goes on to say that no one person can speak for a person of color. She goes on that Justice Clarence Thomas represents a part, but not the whole, of African-American thought. I think he represents very little of African-American thought. And then she goes on to talk about the famous dictum attributed to Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Then she writes, like a good academic, that she's not so sure that Justice O'Connor is the author of the line, but the line that a wise old man and a wise old woman will reach the same conclusion in deciding cases. And, of course, Justice O'Connor is saying that to suggest that women are different from men. You can hire us just like the men, and we'll decide the same way. If only the law were that clear. Quoting Sotomayor now, first, there can never be a universal definition of wise. Second, I would hope that a wise Latina woman with the richness of her experiences would more often than not reach a better conclusion than a white male who hasn't lived that life. Let me repeat it again because you're going to hear these lines a lot in the various attack commercials and so forth. First, there can never be a universal definition of wise. Second, I would hope that a wise Latina woman, with the richness of her experiences, would more often than not reach a better conclusion than a white male who hasn't lived that life. So she'd hope that a Latina woman with rich experiences would more often than not reach a better conclusion than a white male who hasn't lived that life. In other words, when you have more experiences than someone else, when you've seen life from both sides, Joni Mitchell's one of my favorite songs says, I've seen love from both sides now. Most of us have, right? Most of us have broken up with someone who was really into us, and we have been broken up by someone we're really into, right? We've seen love from both sides. We've loved someone more than they've loved us, and vice versa. And that makes you wiser than if you're only someone people are attracted to and you're constantly rejecting others, or if you're constantly being rejected. She's seen love from both sides now. Well, when you're a Latino woman who grows up in a housing project, you've seen life from both sides. She's seen it from the poor side, from the minority side. She's seen sexism. She's seen racism. She's seen all the ways that Americans are harmed by being poor. And she's also seen the advantages of being rich. She's been a Second Circuit judge for, 17 years or so, with more judicial experience than anyone in the last 100 years that's been appointed to the United States Supreme Court. She's seen the good life, too. She's been a prosecutor. She's prosecuted people that have done crimes. She's been a civil litigator. She's done business trials. She's seen it from both sides. So she says she would hope that a wise Latina woman with the richness of her experiences would more often than not reach a better conclusion than the white male who hasn't lived that life. Those words alone are what Newt Gingrich is calling racist, or reverse racist, whatever that is, and urging her to step down. But let's listen to the rest of what she said. Is it really racist? Is she saying that a white male can never get it? Listen to the very next line of her speech. Quote, let us not forget that wise men like Oliver Wendell Holmes and Justice Cardozo voted on cases which upheld both sex and race discrimination in our society. Unquote. Hey, pretty good. Two white males upheld race and sex discrimination. Going on, quote, until 1972, no Supreme Court case had ever upheld the claim of a woman in a gender discrimination case. I, like Professor Carter, believe that we should not be so myopic as to believe that others of different experiences or backgrounds are incapable of understanding the values and needs of people from a different group. Many are so capable. As Judge Cederbaum has pointed out, 9 white men on the Supreme Court in the past have done so on many occasions and on many issues, including Brown. Unquote. That's right. Brown versus Board of Education was decided by 9 white men. And Judge Sotomayor is showing that she recognizes that some white men get it. Hardly reverse racism. But she goes on to say, quote, however, to understand takes time and effort, something that not all people are willing to give. For others, their experiences limit their ability to understand the experiences of others. Others simply do not care. Hence, one must accept the proposition that a difference there will be by the presence of women and people of color on the bench. Personal experiences affect the facts that judges choose to see. I'm going to repeat that. Great line. Personal experiences affect the facts that judges choose to see. My hope is that I will take the good from my experiences and extrapolate them further into areas with which I am unfamiliar. I simply do not know exactly what that difference will be in my judging, but I accept there will be some based on my gender and my Latina heritage. Unquote. Seems pretty reasonable to me. Love that line. Personal experiences affect the facts that judges choose to see. It doesn't change the facts, and it doesn't change the law, but it affects the facts that judges choose to see. Think of the Lilly Ledbetter case. Classic case. Here is a woman that worked in the same company for some 30 years. And for some 30 years was paid less than her male counterparts in exactly the same position. And for 30 years she was mistreated. She discovers it in her 30th year, brings a court case, and the court upholds by a 5-4 decision of the conservative justices that she's lost those 29 and a half years of pay. She can sue only for the last 6 months because, there's a 6-month statute of limitations. And she says, but I didn't know they were mistreating me. I didn't know that they were being prejudiced against me. I didn't know they were paying me less than the men. And the justices said, well, you should have known. Next case. People choose the facts. Personal experiences affect the facts that judges choose to see. Isn't that exactly what Judge Sotomayor is saying? This woman, that a wise heritage might understand how a woman who grew up in poverty wouldn't think to think that her bosses would be mistreating her, wouldn't think to sneak in illegally and look at the salaries, wouldn't think to realize she'd been defrauded all those years. And maybe someone who had been defrauded, as poor people often are, as women often are, as minorities often are, maybe someone of that experience on the bench would recognize why Lilly Ledbetter didn't know for 30 years she'd been cheated. Maybe that kind of person would have the empathy for Lilly Ledbetter to recognize that the law shouldn't be on the side of the cheaters, but on the side of the cheated. Could a white male do that? Sure he could. Sonia Sotomayor understands that. She cited Oliver Wendell Holmes. She cited Benjamin Cardozo, arguably the first Latino on the court. Arguably. So white men can see it, but perhaps Latino woman is more likely to see it. And that's the reverse racism that you're going to hear so much over the next 2 months. Newt Gingrich is going to say it every chance he can. I wanted to give you the full context. Kevin's on the line. Kevin from Brooklyn, welcome to the show.
Hi. Cardozo is the first Latino on the court.
Okay.
Being Jewish is just a religion. It doesn't make you any less American or any less of any nationality. It's just the faith, just like I am Anglican.
I actually looked up his past to find out what the argument was. Cardozo is a descendant of a Portuguese Jewish family. His family had lived in England for several generations before coming to America prior to the American Revolution, and then living in America for many generations. So I'll just state that, and I have no problem calling him the first Latino, or not calling him the first Latino. Well, I you know, it's the same arguments with straight and gay. I think it's like, oh my God, the gay agenda. They're going to make our kids gay.
Well, no.
Right? They're going to get revenge.
No, it's because, you know what it is? It's because I have to do some self-examination whether or not I'm gay. Okay? Because if you give too much, to be honest with you, and please don't take offense at this.
I don't think I will. I don't think there's anything you could say that could offend me, Kevin. Go ahead.
No, I'm all for gay rights and for gays being married 1,001%. And you know why? Out of absolute selfish reasons, it leaves more options.
More women for you.
Exactly.
Well, that's logical. That's not offensive.
You know, it's like, please, I want you to be able to get married. I want you to adopt children, because I am tired of seeing black children running amok on the streets.
You know, there are a lot of black
children adopted. It's homosexual couples.
There's actually a lot of black children that have been adopted by gay couples because
there
are not enough people adopting black children. It's unfortunate for all the people that talk about abortion. Right.
Too few white couples
are willing to adopt black children, and gay couples are much more likely, even if they're white, to adopt black children. It's percentage wise.
Yeah. Well, too few black couples are adopting black children. And I can hardly blame them, because if anything, I say you guys are performing a public service.
Absolutely.
And I think you guys should be rewarded. You guys should even get more rights. You know?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, take kids out of the foster.
Double tax exemption.
The state, a lot of money. And it costs us all a lot of money, not just to provide for foster kids, but frankly, foster kids often are in trouble with the law. And then there's the cost of incarcerating them or dealing with people on welfare. I mean, you have a good family, that's far less likely to happen. So that's another.
I'm related to a gay couple. A cousin of mine, he and his partner adopted, two young boys. Adopt them, not even foster care, adopt them. It's a great thing, you know, saving two lives that could have ended up elsewhere.
It certainly is.
Yeah.
Thanks for your call, Kevin. I appreciate it. I particularly appreciate that psychological point, which I hadn't really thought out. This idea that a lot of conservative white men fear that this Latino woman, you sort of imagine, I don't know, trying to think of I'm so bad at pop culture. some Latino woman's going to run, you know, roughshod over them or something.
Oh, yeah. Okay, have a good one.
Thanks for your call. I appreciate it. Anyway, I was looking at some other firsts. Maybe Cardozo was the first. Fine. So she's the second. But definitely she represents a new population in America. But I was reading about some of the other firsts. The first Jew on the court was Louis Brandeis. And he was appointed in 1916 by a Democrat, President Woodrow Wilson. And it's funny to read the press accounts at the time. This is all from the Washington Post. They write, quote, "His blood brought him early in his career in touch with men of his race exploited in sweatshops," unquote. Isn't that funny? Doesn't that sound awful 100 years later? And yet the point being that he had empathy with those in the lower classes still remains. And, of course, Brandeis was a big Zionist in 1916, and many Jews felt he wasn't Orthodox enough. Then, of course, Thurgood Marshall, first African-American justice in 1967. Thurgood Marshall had one of the longest confirmation processes in modern political history, the Washington Post tells us. I didn't realize that it was such a fight to get him on the court. I wasn't around in 1967. In the end, 20 senators did not vote on his nomination at all. Interesting. Those must have been all the Southern Democrats. So this is something. Something political. It does matter. And I've been trying to read everything I can about Sotomayor. The thing is, she's generally upheld the law. It's not that interesting. I don't see cases where she stood on the limb. They're not going to be able to attack her based on her cases because she ruled according to the law. They'll talk about the New Haven firefighters case where she and four other justices unanimously agreed to apply the law as it currently exists in a boring, unpublished opinion that really wasn't even that exciting, that threw out the test that gave disproportionate advantage to the whites. That's all they got. So this battle will be seen as a harbinger of things to come. This is all foreshadowing. This is the warm-up match. This is the pregame season. She will be approved. But the Republicans are going to throw everything they can. Well, not the Republicans. I take that back. The conservative interest groups are going to throw everything they can against her so that when a real liberal is chosen, they can say, ah, this person is far to the left of Judge Sotomayor. But Republicans, as distinct from conservative groups, are likely to hold their fire. They recognize that the Latina vote is 15% of Americans and is likely to grow to be a third of Americans over the next generation or two. They don't dare. And if they do dare, then they're even stupider than I thought they were. One more exchange on Judge Sotomayor, and then I'll get to some other issues, just because I thought this was fascinating. I was reading about her confirmation hearing back in 1997. She'd been held over for over a year. Again, she was nominated by George Bush Sr. in 1992 as a compromise, her and a conservative judge. And then she was appointed to the federal appellate bench in 97 from the district judge bench. And I was looking to see anything she had possibly said on gay rights. I was curious. And this is the only thing I found. She hasn't had a case on it, only from her confirmation hearing. Listen to this. I love this. This is a question from Senator John Ashcroft. You know John Ashcroft. He later lost to a dead guy and then became attorney general. Well, then Senator John Ashcroft was concerned because a gay inmate had sued prison officials. They had stopped him from serving food. You know, all prisoners get a chance to do some work and to earn a little pay and to earn some time off for good behavior. So they work in the kitchen, right? They do KP duty. Well, this gay guy was removed because he was gay. And he had the audacity to sue and to say he should have the same rights to work in the kitchen as any other inmate. Which Ashcroft put it, this is a direct quote from John Ashcroft, I love this. Removing him, Ashcroft supported because, quote, it would prevent disciplinary problems that could arise from having open homosexuals prepare food. Unquote. I love it. Ashcroft said, of course you can't let the gay people serve food, because by firing the guy, it prevents disciplinary problems that could arise from having open homosexuals prepare food. I don't think Ashcroft had ever been to a French restaurant. Having open homosexuals prepare food. Does he know the great New York chefs? Probably not. Anyway, Ashcroft asked her if she believed that there is a constitutional right to homosexual conduct by prisoners. That's a very different question. In other words, do the prisoners have a right to have sex in jail? And Sotomayor answered, no, sir, there's not. The only constitutional right that homosexuals have, she said, is the same constitutional right every citizen of the United States has, which is not to have government action taken against them arbitrarily and capriciously. Pretty solid and pretty firm in protecting gay rights, at least as I read it. Bunch of other issues on my plate today, which I will get to. I also want to take more of your calls. 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. I'll be right back after this.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. The right wing's response to Sonia Sotomayor's appointment has been a festival of foolishness. Glenn Beck called her not that bright. Let's see now. She graduated from Princeton, summa cum laude, which is Latin, I believe, for off the charts smart. Republicans like Rush Limbaugh and Pat Buchanan have started calling Judge Sotomayor a racist, which takes a bit of chutzpah since they've trafficked in racism their whole careers. Newt Gingrich has also been throwing that same spear. They're all seizing on a comment Sotomayor made in a 2001 speech in which she said, "I'd hoped that a wise Latina woman with the richness of her experience would more often than not reach a better conclusion than a white male who hasn't lived that life." Now, what's wrong with that? If you've lived through racial and sexual discrimination, as many Latinas have and white men have not, chances are those experiences will give you a finer appreciation of what equal protection under the law really means and why it really matters. On a court that just a term ago restricted the right of women to sue on the grounds of sex discrimination, we could use more of that. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. A lot of things on my plate. I do. We'll be talking about Sonia Sotomayor from now until she's confirmed. But I did want to mention one more thing, because the other thing you're going to hear, the thing you're mostly going to hear, is that she's a reverse racist. I think I've dealt with that in detail. The other remark that you may hear is even stupider, if possible, an attack. And that's that she advocated legislating from the bench, because she said that the Court of Appeals is where policy is made. I think most lawyers, most students recognize that's simply a fact. And she said it shouldn't be that way, it just is. Let me read to you, again, context always matters, let me read to you the context of her comment. Academia, public interest law, legal defense funds, they're all looking for people with Court of Appeals experience, because it is, Court of Appeals is where policy is made. And I know this is on tape, and I should never say that because we don't make law. I know. Okay, I know. I'm not promoting it, and I'm not advocating it. I'm, you know. Okay. Having said that, The Court of Appeals is where, before the Supreme Court makes the final decision, the law is percolating. Its interpretation, its application. I mean, could she be any more clear? I know this is on tape. I know I should never say that because we don't make law. I know I'm not promoting it. I'm not advocating it. Okay. I'm not advocating it. But she'd be a fool not to recognize that it's true. And Judge Sotomayor is many things, but she's not a fool. The Court of Appeals is where policy is made. The Supreme Court takes less than 100 cases a year. And everyone has a right in a federal case to an appeal to the Court of Appeals. Every federal case has a right to go to the Court of Appeals. And only a tiny fraction goes to the Supreme Court. So where is policy made? In the Court of Appeals. That's why the Democrats cared so much about it and threatened to filibuster some really extreme judges under George W. Bush. Because the Court of Appeals is where most policy is made. It's simply a fact. She's not advocating it. She's just recognizing it. And, by the way, her name is Judge Sotomayor, Matt Rothschild. Hope you correct that in your next commentary. So let's talk about some other things. I want to talk about Roland Burris. Never let it be said that I don't condemn Democratic corruption as much as I condemn Republican corruption. Corruption knows no political parties, and Roland Burris is a corrupt guy. Now, at first, I thought he was just a national joke. But now that the FBI has released the recording, specifically a Chicago federal judge has released the recording by the FBI, a recording of Burris telling the governor's brother, Rob Blagojevich, that he was willing to attend a fundraising event for the governor. He was going to ask his friends to donate as well. I've heard enough. Burris said that he never actually gave the money to Rob Blagojevich after the call. Does it matter? I didn't give him any money. I didn't raise any money, Burris told reporters, according to the article. But you see, Burris filed an affidavit. An affidavit is a statement under oath. At a time when it wasn't sure he'd be seated in the Senate, he filed an affidavit saying he had no contact with Blagojevich's allies. Well, I think his brother is his ally. And then later on, he said he had limited contact, and then finally, after being caught, he acknowledged the contact with the brother. Now look. I defended Bill Clinton when he... some would say lied under oath. Others would simply say obfuscated under oath, which I think is the better word to use, about whether or not he was cheating on his wife. Didn't think Bill Clinton should have been impeached, but I didn't defend his conduct. I just don't think these are questions he should have been asked. It's unfair to ask a man under oath about adultery. It is not unfair to ask a politician under oath about whether or not he made promises to a governor in order to get appointed to the Senate, particularly a governor with such massive corruption as Rob Blagojevich. Burris lied under oath not about cheating on his wife, but about corruption. And I think Burris has to go. Now, to be fair, he can be replaced. The new Democratic governor, Pat Quinn, the lieutenant governor under Blagojevich, who was elected separately and has no ties to Blagojevich, he's now governor. He can appoint a fine, upstanding Democrat. There are many, many choices. If you want to ask my personal favorite, I've always loved Jan Schakowsky, Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky of Illinois. She's brilliant. She's fiery. She's a powerful liberal voice. I'd love to see Senator Schakowsky. But whomever it is, it shouldn't be Roland Burris. He needs to go. And people need to call for him to go. And Democrats need to call for him to go so that we are respected later when we complain about Republicans who are corrupt. And because it's just the right thing to do. The man needs to go. Already Democrats have said they won't support him if he runs in 2010. That's certainly the right thing, but it's not enough. I'd like to hear a drumbeat. I don't want there to be any question about whether we like or accept corrupt actions in our party. I don't think we should. On to other things. We have the GM bankruptcy around the corner. I think it was probably a necessary act. Well, let's face it. The GM just wasn't going to survive, and the bondholders were not going to let it survive. They wanted to be paid back when they made a bad investment in a bad company at 3 cents on the dollar. They wanted to get the full dollar back. You know, lots of people made bad bets. Lots of people bet in the market and lost two-thirds or so. Why should GM bondholders be any better? I like the way Obama has responded. While it's not exactly clear the outlines, it appears that 70% will be owned by American taxpayers and 20% by the UAW. And that seems about right to me. The workers are the people who made the company. They are the people who are mostly affected by all the closures. They need to have an important say in how that company's run. GM should not go out of business. This is not the end of General Motors. Bankruptcy does not mean the end. It does not mean liquidation in most cases, particularly of large companies. This is mere reorganization. And I think it will come out stronger for it. But I think it has to happen. Meanwhile, in California, I talked about this yesterday with regard to Prop 8. No one should have a vote on civil rights. But I've been reading more about the proposition system and how much harm it's causing them because of their budget. Again, I touched on this yesterday, but I just want to finish where I really didn't have a chance to finish yesterday. Proposition 13 was the beginning of the great conservative backlash. It happened in June 1978 at a time when Jimmy Carter was president of the United States and the Democrats controlled both houses of Congress. Believe it or not, they actually had a filibuster-proof majority then. But it was the beginning of the conservative revolution, the beginning, really the first time, the Republican Party would be tied to lower taxes. This was not a Republican ideal. John F. Kennedy cut taxes. Richard Nixon had, in fact, negative taxation, which meant that he gave people who didn't pay income taxes money back. Wow, what a liberal Nixon would be considered today. Gerald Ford appointed Justice Stevens. Republicans were not known as the anti-tax party until Proposition 13. Which told the state of California they couldn't raise property taxes more than a very, very limited amount. It was based on assessments. And you just couldn't say that a property went up 1% in value, more than 1% in value, even if it went up 10, 20, 50%. To this day, there are commercial properties assessed in their 1978 levels. And I'll be happy to buy any property in the whole state of California at its 1978 level. I guarantee you these properties have tripled, quadrupled, gone up 10 times. The problem with these schemes by voters to lower taxes is that it helps, doesn't really lower taxes. What it does is it just redistributes taxes. In California's case, it redistributed the tax from the people who newly arrived to the people who'd been a long time there, right? If you've been there since 1978, you got a great deal. If you're a newcomer, you got to pay higher taxes to make up for the people who pay less taxes. It is unequal. But the people in 78 could vote against the people yet to arrive in California. Why the heck not? Doesn't affect them any. It helps them at the expense of their children. It's kind of like voting to protect marriage when you're not gay. And it doesn't affect you whether or not gay people can have marriage. It's very, very easy to vote against someone else's rights. And that's the problem with direct democracy. The other stupid thing that California did, California voters did, was they said that you need a two-thirds majority in both houses to raise taxes. So even though the Democrats control both branches of the California state legislature, the Republicans have barely held on to a third of each. And that means that you can't raise taxes, even tobacco taxes. At the same time, the people are voting for more funding. More funding, less taxes, massive, massive budget deficit, which under the California Constitution, you're not allowed to have either. The people voted for a contradiction. And because of that, California, which in the 1970s had some of the best schools, the best roads in the country, has now some of the worst schools and the worst roads in the country. California was fifth among states in per pupil spending in the 1950s and 60s. Now it's down to the mid-40s, around near the state of Mississippi. There's 11% unemployment. There's no more money left in California. But the Republicans are saying, no, we already pay taxes that are too high. Actually, according to the Citizens for Tax Justice, listen to this, the top 1% pays 7.4% of their income to the state, while the poorest Californians pay 10.2%. That's right. In California, the poorest pay a higher percentage of the meager income they have than the very, very rich. It's a mess. Maybe the poor people don't know that. Maybe they don't vote. But one of the things about representative democracy is you have people there who understand the budget, unlike most ordinary voters, and can make decisions, weighing one against another to determine what's best. Frankly, any time you have a majority vote to make a two-thirds supermajority, I think you have a problem. If two-thirds of the voters vote to require a two-thirds vote, that's one thing, but for half to require two-thirds, well, that's just kind of weird. That's just kind of weird. And then they can't undo it. And now they're going to turn to the federal government for money? I don't want to give them a penny, and yet California is the nation's largest state. It's some one-seventh of the entire nation's economy. What are we going to do? Well, we need to repeal the two-thirds threshold. We need to repeal the Proposition 13. And we need to get rid of ballot box initiatives that allow majority votes to amend the Constitution. It's one thing to amend, to make a law. I happen to like the majority vote in California that bans smoking indoors. I worked very hard on that. That's not a civil right, smoking indoors in public places. But California's got to get its act together. Other things in the news, we don't have much time. Obviously, I'm very concerned about North Korea and its nuclear weapon. Obama has said he's going to respond very strongly. I hope he does. He needs to. Because if he doesn't respond strongly, it will be seen as a green light to North Korea to go way off the charts. He needs to gather the world together, use his diplomatic skills, and sanction North Korea hard. It's very dangerous. Not just for Kim Jong-il, but for any terrorist group they could sell the weapons to. This is something that should unite Democrats and Republicans together to prevent. Barack Obama is in the Middle East. I hope that he tells Egypt what Egypt needs to hear, namely that they have to care about human rights. Because Egypt may be a U.S. ally now, but it is a dictatorship. It tortures as many people as Saddam Hussein did at the time that Iraq was invaded. And if enough people hate the Egyptian dictatorship and it turns against us, we'll have a threat as bad as Iran. He's got to walk that line. He's got to care about human rights. And he needs to tell the Saudi prince the same thing. That's it for the show. I hope you will tune in next week when I report live from the Campaign for America's Future. For now, this is Mark Levine, signing off.